first, and could you kind of outline for the court what your understanding is of who's going to use what time? And
I am asking to reserve 6 minutes to discuss the case in chief on whether or not there was a fraudulent transfer. The remaining 6 minutes are reserved by the attorneys representing myself and Mr. Kokel, who were the attorneys in the case and sanctioned. And then we have reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. You may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Catherine Durr, and I am the attorney for the cross appellant in this case, Atelli Partners. This case started when a creditor of Mr. Luther became aware of a security interest that he gave his wife in substantially all of his assets and his future right to receive it.
Your time is short, so I'm going to jump in right to a question.
Sure.
I have. What was the specific asset that you're alleging was transferred?
The transfer was the security interest. Okay.
So the security interest itself is the asset?
Yes.
It's a security interest in what?
A security interest in all of his assets.
Which are identified as what?
Any personal property, his right to be, he makes money through consulting fees, so it included his right to receive that money. It was to be paid to her.
But the plaintiffs acknowledged at one point there were no identifiable assets transferred. The security interest in itself was the only thing they were pointing as the asset.
Yes, and a transfer of a security interest can be a fraudulent transfer under the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. So I think it's important to note that although a physical asset was not transferred, the security interest is considered a transfer that can be fraudulent under the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act.
But under that act, that's not normally applied to speculative assets, as we have here, where there may or may not be an asset. Is that correct?
What we're talking about is his right to receive income in the future. And when you look at the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act, it says that if the transfer has not occurred until after the lawsuit was filed, it's treated as if it occurred right before the trial. So the fact that it's future income that he may or may not earn is really beside the point. Because if he does earn it under these facts, and Mr. Korth or my client say attach that money first, Mrs. Luther's lawyers are going to say, hey, you committed conversion. That belongs to us as collateral under our security agreement.
So what the plaintiffs here were seeking was basically a declaration of a priority lien.
Exactly. They're claiming that they have the first and prior right to any of Mr. Luther's assets before any of his other creditors.
Would that be different upon the classification of the asset, if it's a home, or if it's a real estate, or if it's income?
No. I think the term asset is described in the Uniform Commercial Code very broadly. Certainly, under the Uniform Commercial Code, you know, a right to payment is an asset that can be pledged. And essentially, that's what happened here.
The IRS would have a right, a priority right. Wouldn't they have any future earnings before your clients?
Well, until they were paid,
right.
That's true.
Right.
But they were paid.
So and this amount satisfied that debt and removed that priority. Is that having an impact on your argument?
Yeah, I think that goes to reasonably equivalent value. Was reasonably equivalent value exchanged? And we're
$1.5 million for IRS, $400,000 for this. I don't know if my numbers are right, but
yes, the amount of his debts were reduced. But that's also true any time a debtor pays one of his creditors. Okay. It can, the transfer that we're complaining of is not that she paid the IRS and therefore paved the way for other assets to be attached. Did she have a right to take a security interest in his future assets, including his rights to payment?
Up to the amount that she
$450,000, yes.
Plus interest.
Yes. And I think that it's that reasonably equivalent value that the district court and the appellant, the appellees are arguing, well, we gave reasonably equivalent value, and this is a legitimate debt. Okay. Again, we're not arguing about the payment to the IRS. What we're arguing is she took that security interest with the intent to hinder and delay Mr. Luther's other creditors.
Up to the extent that she transferred money to pay the IRS debt. It's not forever, indefinite, all earnings. It's only up to what she loaned him to pay off that.
Well, that's part of the problem, Your Honor. This is a demand note. And again, we can't forget, this is a transfer between a husband and a wife. They are always presumed to be fraudulent. And the question is, did, based on all of the indices of fraud, did she meet her burden of proof that to overcome that presumption? And at the summary judgment stage, the district court said, no, she didn't overcome her burden. So we're going to go to trial on this issue of, did she act in good faith? And I think if you read the case...
Then the trial judge ultimately finds she's the only credible witness in the case.
That's what he said, yes. But this, again, that goes to what standard are we going to apply good faith?
Well, let's stop right there, because I think my next question takes a little bit. What specific statutory provision are the plaintiffs asserting the fraudulent transfer occurred under?
705A1. And under 705A1, and we look at Section 709A, her defense was she gave reasonably equivalent value and acted in good faith. And the trial court said, well, subjectively, you know, I believe her. But this, the standard on review in this case is de novo. And what we would look to are the indices of fraud. We look at that first. Were there certain badges of fraud that a reasonable person would have cause to inquire further? Why do I need a security interest? Why do I need this collateral control agreement? And again, she had attorneys representing her. She claims that I don't know anything, I relied on my attorneys. Well, the fact of the matter is, her attorneys are presumed to know what is the purpose of a security agreement. It's to prevent other creditors from attaching those assets before you, taking your collateral. They're presumed to know the presumed effect of this particular transfer, that it's subject to attack as a fraudulent transfer. So she had I believe that knowledge is inferred to her. And in fact, this court in other cases has imputed in a similar type of transaction on whether or not someone was a bona fide purchaser, that they have said, well, no, your attorney knew about it, so you're not a bona fide transfer.
Counsel, you're not arguing that under the de novo standard of review, we cannot consider that the trial court found her testimony to be credible, are you?
No, I'm not saying that.
All right.
But I do want to point out that there were certain things presented at trial that were maybe overlooked by the trial judge or ignored, if we're going to believe her.
What evidence in the record was there that she did not act in good faith?
Well,
is that the crux of the case?
I'm sorry, is that
what? Is that the crux of the case, that she did not act in good faith?
Yes.
And what evidence in the record is it that she did not act in good faith?
Well, I've outlined in my brief on both sides, I've outlined various, at least 20 or 25 indices that she should have challenged this transaction, or that she actually knew the purpose was to hinder and delay, which the security interest certainly did, Michael's other creditors. She knew Michael had other creditors. She admitted that. She knew that the collateral control agreement, which involved the $100,000 her husband was to receive from his business partner, she knew the collateral control agreement meant she could take that money. Okay, she understood and had actual, and I'm saying to you that if we believe her, she had actual intent to hinder and delay.
Did she have other intentions?
Well, of course she wanted, again, she said, I want to be paid first. I want to be paid before Michael's other creditors. There's nothing wrong with that. The question is, did she, the transfer of the security interest. And again, this is a husband and wife. Why does a wife need a security interest in her husband's assets if it's not to ensure that she get paid first? She knew he had other creditors. She knew he was insolvent. She knew that the purpose of the security agreement, because she admits this at trial, was to make sure that creditors I know he has won't take this $100,000 before me.
And that's a fraudulent intent?
Well, I think that's a misnomer.
She wants to be in first position at the end of the day. Is that what she seeks?
And again, when we look in arm's length transactions, that's what happens. But this isn't an arm's length transaction. This is a husband and wife. And would a reasonable person in those circumstances do take steps further, like a bank?
Well, I don't think any bank would loan Mr. Cord any money.
No,
is
I
that
agree.
Correct?
That's
and,
correct.
And isn't she concerned about the home that she owns and resides in? Isn't, has the IRS threatened to take that from her?
Well, if we
aren't those legitimate concerns?
She... I guess my rebuttal time has started, so I'll stop for now. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So how much time have we? Okay, there are 2 minutes left. What we're going to do here is Mr. Laughlin and Ms. Jorgensen, we will give each of, well, Mr. Laughlin, you wanted 4.5 minutes.
Correct.
We'll give you 2 minutes, and Ms. Jorgensen will give you the 1.5 minutes that you had requested, and then we'll put additional time on the Appleby's case. And there will be no time for rebuttal. So, Mr. Laughlin.
Even if you affirm the judgment, we feel that the sanctions should be overruled. The remember, this is a fraudulent transfer is an or. Either we have to prove intent to defraud or hinder creditors, or the reasonably equivalent value. The court got hung up on the reasonably equivalent value. The defendants filed a summary judgment motion and motion for sanctions, and the court said no, there's badges of fraud. There's, in fact, shifted the presumption. There's a presumption of fraud that doesn't have anything to do with reasonably equivalent value. And then when it got to trial, as two justices noted, the court evaluated the credibility of Ms. Luther, and based on the court's evaluation of credibility, said, I'm going to reverse my earlier finding that there was a genuine issue of material fact. I'm going to go even further and say that it was frivolous, that it was ridiculous, that it was absurd, that it should have never been filed. And the court we respectfully suggest got the law wrong. The court said it is also important to note that one of the necessary elements for the claim for us is that reasonable equivalent value was not given. This court explicitly found that reasonable equivalent value had been given. We maintain the claims against Laura Luther despite this clear signal that they would be unable to establish a necessary element. The court confused the or and he turned it into an and. All we had to do was have a good faith belief, not be frivolous, that these people had an intent to defraud. And so there's kind of a gotcha here that I think this court should really think about. In terms of what are we supposed to do here? We're told, hey, your pleadings aren't frivolous. In fact, you get to go to trial here, and then there's more attorney's fees that come up, and then the court changes its mind and comes back. The Luthers, the evidence was clear that they made an art form of avoiding creditors. Mr. Luther, it's undisputed, has multiple judgments for multiple millions of dollars and avoided them for multiple years. He did this because he had oral contracts for property interests. He had $300,000 per year coming into his bank account and immediately went out to other sham corporations. He put his own personal funds together with corporate funds. The evidence in the record is replete that there's nobody, or Mr. Luther made an art form out of avoiding creditors with the intent to hinder. And so that's why we're here to say, take your de novo review, because if you can't do it here on your de novo review, you shouldn't be able to do it. But at a minimum, Your Honors, this is absolutely, clearly, clearly not frivolous. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Jorgensen.
May it please the Court, I'm here on behalf of Attorney Catherine Durr, who was also sanctioned in this case. In this case, although, as the justices have said, it is correct that you can want to be paid first. But what is key in this case, and why this case is clearly not frivolous, is that the note that we're talking about was a demand note, on which there were no payments made, and it was a debt between husband and wife. Laura Luther had total control over whether this debt was ever paid or whether there was always a security interest in front of every other creditor. For that reason, this case was not frivolous to bring, and Ms. Luther was involved in an IRS case, as is indicated on the record. An IRS case that included multiple other creditors. She was very aware of the multitude of debts that were out there. Ms. Durr's argument is just slightly different than Mr. Kochel's in that Ms. Durr represented Atelier Partners, who did not actually enter the case in which sanctions were entered until a year later. It is our position that sanctions were clearly not should not have been entered in this case. This case did not meet the standard for frivolousness, but nonetheless, a proportionate amount of sanctions to the degree the court finds that they should be entered, and there were 450 pages of transcript that preceded Atelier Partners' entry into the case. Thank you.
Before you sit down, is the court had assured both of the attorneys at one point that there would be no sanctions directly assessed against the attorneys, correct?
Correct. I think that was...
And then later changed his mind and then did directly assess those against the attorneys.
That is correct, and I believe prevented an expert from testifying on everything.
That was my question. If that assurance had not been made at the time it was, what evidence was... What nature of evidence was going to be introduced by the attorneys in defense of that?
I apologize, I'm the wrong attorney. That was Mr. Kochel's expert. So I am unsure with the full amount of what the intent of the expert was, but the expert was to speak to the fee. I do know that they speak to the amount, type of fees, and the assessment of fees.
Was that expert prevented from testifying fully by the judge?
It is my understanding that is correct. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Skolka, are you going to argue first?
Yes, Your Honor. Ron, how much time to quote?
We're going to give you 16 minutes. We'll give you a total of 20 minutes, actually, between the two of you. Okay, 13 minutes for you.
Yes, Your Honor.
May proceed.
May it please the court, I am Dave Skalka, representing Appellee Laura Luther. From the late Honorable Mark Ashford, from his two orders and findings on the record in the case awarding attorney's fees under Section 825.824 for what he said was the first time in his long career on the bench in resolving the case. The court finds the defendant's arguments that there can be no intent to hinder, where the estate was improved in position rather than diminished, compelling. Where the effect of the transfer does not diminish the estate, it is not a fraudulent transfer. In the present case, the transfer of $450,000 from Laura to Michael in exchange for the lien of his personal property was intended and used for the settlement of the IRS suit and the extinguishment of the IRS liens relevant to that suit. These liens were higher in priority than either the Korth judgment or the Adelaide judgment. Thus, by acquiring the loan and settling the IRS suit, Michael exchanged over $1.2 million in debt for $450,000 in debt, improving his estate by more than $750,000 and putting Korth and Adelaide that much closer to collecting on their judgment liens. It is obviously clear to me that that action itself, the $450,000 to resolve the settlement of the IRS lien, was known to everybody long before this lawsuit was had. Despite receipt of the loan documentation, Korth and Adelaide Partners persisted in their claims against Laura Luther. The actions against Laura Luther were totally without merit and without a rational argument based upon the law and the evidence at trial.
I want to talk about the assets being transferred before we get into the rest of that. You heard the dialogue I had with Mr.
I did, Your Honor.
Can a security agreement, such as we had here, be deemed an asset to be transferred?
Security agreement can be an asset, yes. I would agree with that.
In this situation where it's a speculative?
It's not speculative. Well, it is and it isn't, Your Honor. It is, I think, as another justice mentioned, it was limited. It wasn't a security interest in all assets of some infinite value. It secured repayment of $450,000.
In the absence of security interest, were there any assets identified as being transferred between the Luthers?
No assets were transferred. Just the security interest, a lien in rights to payment and personal property. And but there wasn't anything specific.
And the court actually had ruled upon that during the summary judgment stage, didn't it? When it said that there was no lien identified for the lien priority argument being made by the plaintiffs at that time?
Right, that this wasn't a lien priority case.
Right.
There wasn't an execution. We didn't have a situation where Korth and Adelaide had executed on an asset. And the question was, and contrary to what I think Ms. Durr tried to say, that this was some case about declaration of priority. It wasn't, specifically because of the summary judgment ruling. Because there wasn't an execution on an asset, there wasn't a lien priority to discuss. And therefore, when they first came in on their summary judgment, they tried to get a summary judgment on the idea that the UCC filing was invalid. And the court said, you don't have standing because I don't have a case in front of me that would let me decide that issue.
And during the defendant's motion to compel on one of the discovery issues, the plaintiffs had basically stated that there was no asset or interest other than the security agreement transferred.
The only thing that was transferred as part of this loan transaction was Laura gave $450,000 to the benefit of Michael directly to the IRS, and he transferred a security interest to her. There were no other assets transferred.
Secured by
whatever personal property he had that could attach, but there wasn't discussion at trial about if anything attached, and his rights to payment, his future rights to payment.
So what definition of security interest do you think best supports the idea that this asset was a security interest? UCC, securities law, common law.
UCC. There was an actual security interest document that's in the record that was signed by Michael Luther.
And that would be the best source for identifying this thing that happened as a security interest.
Absolutely. There was loan documentation that, in fact, as Judge Ashford noted, the plaintiffs had, the appellants had, and were aware that, and it made specific that it was only securing this $450,000 loan.
And it's definite enough, in your view, to be so identified within the definitions of UCC?
Clearly. No issue at all on that, Your Honor. Absolutely not.
Counsel, if Mr. Luther were to receive a lump sum payment from one of his employers, contract people, and he received a $100,000 payment, what would happen at that point? If Mr. Luther doesn't make any demand, and so does Korth and have the right to come in and then attach that $100,000?
If they were to garnish, right?
Well, it wouldn't be.
That right to payment. Yeah, it would be. Well, it depends on what stage, right, Your Honor? If it's at the stage that the person that entered a contract with them hasn't paid it yet, it would be a garnishment. If they've already paid it and it's his bank account.
It's an attachment.
If it's an asset, but yeah, it would be a garnishment to the bank account or something like that. And so what would happen is there would be the right of Laura Luther to come in and say, I've only been paid X amount on my loan. I have a security interest that has priority over your immediate present attachment, which is the same result as if the IRS still had its lien.
But if she doesn't make the demand for that $100,000, can Korth come in?
If she doesn't make it would spring upon their garnishment. The issue would come up in garnishment proceedings. She would have a right to intervene in the garnishment and say, I have a priority interest in that money.
And if she doesn't do that, then Korth could garnish that $100,000.
That is correct.
This doesn't bar that exclusively from ever going after these assets.
Absolutely not. It doesn't stop them at all.
Yeah, they could challenge the priority of the lien at that point.
They could, although it was crystal clear, and it's not assigned as error here before this court, that they did not, it was stipulated at the trial that they had never attached onto any personal property from their judgment to Adelaide's going back 10 years, I think, of course, going back 15 or 18 years. They didn't have a lien on any personal property. And that was a matter of law. So they would have a tough time. But they could.
But the
they
challenge could be made, I think, or done right previously. That challenge could still be made at that point.
That's correct.
Let me go back to that, the definiteness of that which is secured. Would you help me out and direct me within the UCC to the universe of things that could be subject to a security interest?
Certainly. So I don't have the security agreement in front of me, but it would have identified those categories that are necessary, such as goods, equipment, those sorts of things. And I think if you review the security agreement, it will provide the sufficient definition. I know exactly what you're talking about, Your Honor. I can't just say, in all assets.
And stuff I might get from any old source. It can't be like that, speculative. So I'm just trying to see how definite it is to see if it is, forgive the expression, a bona fide security interest.
Correct. I think it identifies security agreement, if you look at it, identifies certain property, and it could identify, if it's specific, which it is, specifically rights, future rights to payment. It can
from a specified source?
No, it doesn't have to be from a specified source. Absolutely not.
But that's not my question. My question is, does it designate a specified source?
That document does not. There was one additional document that was part of the loan transaction that was the collateral control agreement that Ms. Durr mentioned, or another counsel, in regards to an entity that Dan Koch owned, because there was a representation by her husband that he was going to be getting paid $100,000 shortly from this company.
From that entity?
Correct.
So I get a security interest in the lottery winnings if I win the lottery. It's got to be tied to something in reality.
It has to define categories.
Categories in general that you believe, therefore, was sufficient?
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor.
Thank you.
What I'm getting back to, and reading from Judge Ashford, is, and what I was getting to, is he talks about the summary judgment motion. And he talked about it in his order granting fees, and he acknowledged that this was an issue. First of all, you have to understand that the summary judgment motions that were before him did not involve, it involved their motion for summary judgment on what we just talked about recently on this issue that never made trial regarding a priority. And we filed a motion for summary judgment specifically on the idea that we thought good faith and reasonably equivalent value were found as a matter of law, and therefore it doesn't matter about their case in chief on 705A1, we could get that as a matter of law. Their case in chief was not before him on summary judgment. Notwithstanding, he says, at the time the summary judgment motions were before the court, the plaintiff represented to this court that he possessed evidence which raised issues of fact as to whether the transfer was done with actual intent to delay or defraud. Court further argued that Laura Luther had refused to provide certain discovery responses and further discovery was necessary before the matter could be disposed. The fact that the court deferred to court's assertions did not fully see what later became apparent at trial, that based on facts which were known to court and Adelaide Partners were not a meritorious claim against Laura Luther, does not ameliorate the frivolous nature of the claims and does not preclude this court from awarding fees. The point of this, and the point of me reading this, is aside from the fact that Judge Ashford's rulings are the best argument I have, is, first of all, as to the trial court's key holding, that where the effect of the transfer does not diminish the estate, it's not a fraudulent transfer, the appellants are silent in their main briefs to this court but for Adelaide Partners, who only then criticizes the citation by the trial court used to support the holding, but itself does not provide any case law contending that that statement is not the law. As to the trial court's findings of fact and law regarding the beneficial effect of the loan transaction to the junior lien creditors, Korth and Adelaide, and Korth and Adelaide's knowledge of this transaction structure at the time the lawsuit was filed, the appellants do not assign or argue error. As to the trial court's explanation of why it believed it was well within its discretion to determine the case was frivolous and award Ms. Luther attorney's fees, notwithstanding it did not dismiss the case on an earlier summary judgment, that it was based on representations of court's counsel that were later determined to not have merit, the appellants did not challenge those findings on their motion to amend before the trial court and did not assign or argue error before this court.
Was the district court's determinations that the actions were frivolous based upon its findings of actual intent and good faith or something else?
It was that the key premise that they were junior creditors, seen junior to the IRS, that there was no possible way that this transaction as put together that benefited the estate, that improved Michael Luther's balance sheet, such that, as Judge Ashford found, they were far closer than they ever were with the IRS's $1.2 million ahead of them to getting paid, that there is no way under law, nothing that you could show that would make this have merit, this claim have merit, as being a fraudulent transfer.
Does the court also not mention that this is also based upon the credibility of the witnesses?
He very much was impressed with and not impressed with, he was impressed with Ms. Luther and he was not very impressed with other witnesses. But his finding of frivolousness, that is more of a description by him of the fact that, excuse me, where did my, oh, that is my time. Okay, just want to make sure. That was an elaboration of what he said first, which is that I didn't see the plaintiffs and appellants didn't provide me any evidence contradicting Laura Luther's testimony. There was no evidence that the $450,000 loan was anything other than a loan. And he goes on through these elements saying these things. And that's an elaboration of, in fact, I found Laura Luther as the only credible witness at trial. That's not the basis of itself of granting attorney's fees, in my view. The point being is, with those findings and what's being argued by the appellants to this court, with the lack of assigned error of argument on these points, this case is positioned to this court as follows. If this court were to determine Judge Ashford abused his discretion in determining the first case filed against Laura Luther was frivolous, having denied summary judgment, it would be saying to practitioners that asserting meritless claims that you can avoid attorney fee sanctions so long as you avoid summary judgment by any means possible. And that's just his first case. As his second.
Counsel, I think you're maybe into your co-counsel's time.
For everyone. Oh, that's what I was asking. That's what I was trying to ask you earlier. Thank you, Your Honor, very much. Your Honor, I would ask that you affirm Judge Ashford in this case. I will leave it to Judge Mr. Weinberg.
Thank you very much. So how much time do we have? 5 minutes and 26 seconds. Mr. Weinberg.
Your Honor, big mistake number one was I settled the tax case as a tax attorney only for the years 04 through 07. What nobody's told you is that for 08 through 15, there were still tax breaks out there that were way ahead of Laura Dodge Luther and were way ahead of the unsecured creditors. Big mistake, because the definition of a fraudulent transfer requires unencumbered assets. They were bricked up, and solidly bricked up.
Is that in our record?
It is in your record in Exhibit 104, which was stipulated to by the parties. All parties stipulated to it. That's why I brought it, the people in from the state with the actual original records. Number two, there's one issue here. When should an attorney or a client know to quit going forward in a case based upon a lack of a viable legal position and stop harassment? Very simple question. I say, after realizing no asset was transferred. The assets are defined in the damn statute. Read the statute. I don't care what these people say. The statute controls. That's the legislature. There was no asset transferred, and there could be no asset transferred that was not unencumbered by the IRS brick and the state of Nebraska brick, the tax liens. And I've cited that in detail. Now, the judge told them outright on July 6, 2015, in denying the summary judgment motion, hey, you ain't got no assets. You got no case. He came right out and told them. They said, all right, don't be a Douglas County dumper. Give us a chance. And he did. But when he figured out what happened, he wasn't happy. And at that time, they paid the price. Now, there are other grounds you could rely on in this case other than the simple statutory language, and that is that they could have, in the federal district court case, gone under a uniform fraudulent transfer on the $450,000 transfer because it was a matter of record that they could have obtained. And if they don't do that under Jensen versus Champion Windows, they can't bring it up here from day one. Now, they could argue the judge didn't rule that, and I could say the Supreme Court can do what they damn well please because you're the Supreme Court and you make the rules and you can look at other grounds to support a position other than what the judge did. Now, what really is here is it's critical, and what the judge relied on was a Kaler case of the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals that said if you don't damage the estate, there's no fraudulent transfer. And that's what he held. What's worse is that after that, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals bankruptcy appellate panel in Wentz, in a Minnesota case, said the same thing and backed it up. And then our chief bankruptcy attorney, a real expert in fraudulent transfers, used the Wentz case in the Maloney case in Nebraska. And I've cited those to you in detail. Now, I also call your attention to a case you decided called Hendrickson v. Messersmith. And basically that case said you look for the assets that are transferred, you see whether they're leaned up, and you go from there. And if they're leaned up, too bad. Now, I could have argued a factual analysis of the judge's decision using the factors going back and forth, but you can say, well, we have a right to go de novo, and I tell you, you have to have clear and convincing evidence to go the other way to find fraud. But the key here is a transfer between husband and wife is not always considered fraudulent. It's rebuttable. And how is it rebuttable? Because there was reasonably equivalent value. If my wife gave me $450,000, I'd be happy to give her a mortgage on whatever I had. And if I had nothing, I'd be overjoyed. And frankly, a beggar can't be a chooser, and that's exactly what my client was. He had nothing, and they knew about it because they've been after him for 12, 15, 18 years solid. Now, the last argument I'm going to make is that you've got to realize that Laura Dodge Luther could and should have got equitably subordinated to the IRS lien from 04 through 07. And thus she would be ahead of everybody, even the IRS, on 08 through 15. Now that's another alternative ground. I've done that before when I worked with the IRS, Chicago, Detroit, and Omaha, and it was a successful approach. It's something to think about as an alternative ground. But what really strikes me in this whole case, what really floors me, is I could never find actual pleadings showing a transfer of an unencumbered asset. Now, there's been a recent case in 2018 in the Eighth Circuit called Stoebner, S-T-O-E-B-N-E-R, the Opportunity Financial LLC, which I cite in my brief, and it says you got to specifically plead in detail the specific act which caused the problem. I'm done. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them specifically. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have no time for rebuttal, so that concludes arguments for the day. The court is adjourned, and you are excused.